Supplement by Frederick Engels. Introduction. The third book of Capital is receiving many and various interpretations ever since it has been subject to public judgment. It was not to be otherwise expected. In publishing it, what I was chiefly concerned with was to produce as authentic a text as possible, to demonstrate the new results obtained by Marx in Marx's own words as far as possible, to intervene myself only where absolutely unavoidable, and even then to leave the reader in no doubt as to who was talking to him. This has been deprecated. It has been said that I should have converted the material available to me in a systematically written book, en faire un livre, as the French say. In other words, sacrifice the authenticity of the text to the reader's convenience. But this was not how I conceived my task. I lacked all justification for such a revision. A man like Marx has the right to be heard himself, to pass on his scientific discoveries to posterity in the full genuineness of his own presentation. Moreover, I had no desire thus to infringe, as it must seem to me, upon the legacy of so preeminent a man. It would have meant to me a breach of faith. And third, it would have been quite useless. For the people who cannot or do not want to read, who, even in Volume 1, took more trouble to understand it wrongly than was necessary to understand it correctly, for such people it is altogether useless to put oneself out in any way. But for those who are interested in a real understanding, the original text itself was precisely the most important thing. For them my recasting would have had at most the value of a commentary, and what is more, a commentary on something unpublished and inaccessible. The original text would have had to be referred to at the first controversy, and at the second and third, its publication in extenso would have become quite unavoidable. Such controversies are a matter of course in a work that contains so much that is new, and in a hastily sketched and partly incomplete first draft to boot. And here my intervention, of course, can be of use, to eliminate difficulties in understanding, to bring more to the fore important aspects whose significance is not strikingly enough evident in the text, and to make some important additions to the text, written in 1865, to fit the state of affairs in 1895. Indeed, there are already two points which seem to me to require a brief discussion. Law of Value and Rate of Profit. It was to be expected that the solution of the apparent contradiction between these two factors would lead to debates just as much after as before the publication of Marx's text. Some were prepared for a complete miracle, and find themselves disappointed because they see a simple, rational, prosaically sober solution of the contradiction, instead of the hocus-pocus they had expected. Most joyfully disappointed, of course, is the well-known, illustrious Loria. He has at last found the Archimedean fulcrum from which even a gnome of his calibre can lift the solidly built, gigantic Marxian structure into the air and explode it. "What?" he declaims indignantly. "Is that supposed to be a solution? That is pure mystification. When economists speak of value, they mean value that is actually established in exchange." Quote, "No economist with any trace of sense has ever concerned himself, or will ever want to concern himself, with a value which commodities do not sell for, and never can sell for. Ne possono vendersi mai. in asserting that the value for which commodities never sell is proportional to the labour they contain, what does Marx do except repeat in an inverted form the thesis of the orthodox economists, that the value for which commodities sell is not proportional to the labour expended on them? Matters are not helped by Marx's saying that despite the divergency of individual prices from individual values, the total price of all commodities always coincides with their total value, or the amount of labour contained in the totality of the commodities. For inasmuch as value is nothing more than the exchange ratio between one commodity and another, the very concept of a total value is an absurdity, nonsense, a contradiction in terms. Unquote. At the very beginning of the book, he argues, Marx says that exchange can equate two commodities only by virtue of a similar and equally large element contained in them, namely, the equal amount of labour. And now he most solemnly repudiates himself by asserting that commodities exchange with one another in a totally different ratio than that of the amount of labour contained in them. Quote, "Was there ever such an utter reductio ad absurdum, such complete theoretical bankruptcy? Was ever scientific suicide committed with greater pomp and more solemnity?" Unquote. Nuova Antologia, February 1, 1895. We see. Our Loria is more than happy. Wasn't he right in treating Marx as one of his own, as an ordinary charlatan? There you see it. Marx sneers at his public, just like Loria. He lives on mystification, just like the most insignificant Italian professor of economics. But whereas Dulcamara can afford that because he knows his trade, the clumsy northerner, Marx, commits nothing but ineptitudes, writes nonsense and absurdities, so that there is nothing left finally for him but solemn suicide. Let us save for later the statement that commodities have never been sold, nor ever can be sold, at the values determined by labour. Let us deal here merely with Mr. Loria's assurance that, quote, value is nothing more than the exchange ratio between one commodity and another, and that therefore the very concept of a total value is an absurdity, nonsense, unquote. The ratio in which two commodities are exchanged for each other, their value, is therefore something purely accidental, stuck onto the commodities from the outside, which can be one thing today and something else tomorrow. Whether a metric hundredweight of wheat is exchanged for a gram or a kilogram of gold does not in the least depend upon conditions inherent in that wheat or gold. For otherwise these conditions would also have to assert themselves in the exchange, dominate the latter on the whole, and also have an independent existence apart from exchange, so that one could speak of a total value of commodities. That is nonsense, says the illustrious Loria. No matter in what ratio two commodities may be exchanged for each other, that is their value, and that's all there is to it. Hence value is identical with price, and every commodity has as many values as the prices it can get. And price is determined by supply and demand, and anyone asking any more questions is a fool to expect an answer. But there is a little hitch to the matter. In the normal state, supply and demand balance. Therefore, let us divide all the commodities in the world into two halves, the supply group and the equally large demand group. Let us assume that each represents a price of 1,000 billion marks, francs, pounds, or what you will. According to elementary arithmetic, that makes a price of 2,000 billions. Nonsense! Absurd! Says Mr. Loria. The two groups together may represent a price of 2,000 billions. But it is otherwise with value. If we say price, 1,000 plus 1,000 equals 2,000. But if we say value, 1,000 plus 1,000 equals zero. at least in this case, where the totality of commodities is involved. For here the commodities of each of the two groups are worth 1,000 billion only because each of the two can and will give this sum for the commodities of the other. But if we unite the totality of the commodities of the two in the hands of a third person, the first has no value in his hand any longer, nor the second, and the third certainly not. In the end, no one has anything. And again we marvel at the superiority with which our sudden Cagliostro has manhandled the concept of value in such a fashion that not the slightest trace of it has been left. This is the acme of vulgar economics. In Braun's Archiv für soziale Gesetzgebung, Volume 7, Number 4, Werner Sombart gives an outline of the Marxian system, which, taken all in all, is excellent. It is the first time that a German university professor succeeds, on the whole, in seeing in Marx's writings what Marx really says, stating that the criticism of the Marxian system cannot consist of a refutation, he says, let the political careerist deal with that, but merely in a further development. Sombart, too, deals with our subject, as is to be expected. He investigates the importance of value in the Marxian system, and arrives at the following results. Value is not manifest in the exchange relation of capitalistically produced commodities. It does not live in the consciousness of the agents of capitalist production. It is not an empirical, but a mental, a logical fact. The concept of value in its material definiteness in Marx is nothing but the economic expression for the fact of the social productive power of labour as the basis of economic existence. In the final analysis, the law of value dominates economic processes in a capitalist economic system, and for this economic system, quite generally has the following content. The value of commodities is the specific and historical form in which the productive power of labour, in the last analysis dominating all economic processes, asserts itself as a determining factor. So, says Sombart, it cannot be said that this conception of the significance of the law of value for the capitalist form of production is wrong. But it does seem to me to be too broad, and susceptible of a narrower, more precise formulation. In my opinion, it by no means exhausts the entire significance of the law of value for the economic stages of society's development dominated by this law. There is a likewise excellent article by Conrad Schmidt on the third volume of Kapital in Braun's Sozialpolitisches Zentralblatt, February 25, 1895, number 22. Especially to be emphasized here is the proof of how the Marxian derivation of average profit from surplus value for the first time gives an answer to the question not even posed by economics up to now. How the magnitude of this average rate of profit is determined, and how it comes about that it is, say, 10 or 15%, and not 50 or 100%. Since we know that the surplus value first appropriated by the industrial capitalist is the sole and exclusive source from which profit and rent flow, this question solves itself. This passage of Schmidt's article might be directly written for economists a la Loria, if it were not labour in vain to open the eyes of those who do not want to see. Schmidt, too, has his formal misgivings regarding the law of value. He calls it a scientific hypothesis, set up to explain the actual exchange process, which proves to be the necessary theoretical starting point, illuminating and indispensable, even in respect of the phenomena of competitive prices, which seem in absolute contradiction to it. According to him, without the law of value, all theoretical insight into the economic machinery of capitalist reality ceases. And in a private letter that he permits me to quote, Schmidt declares the law of value within the capitalist form of production to be a pure, although theoretically necessary, fiction. This view, however, is quite incorrect in my opinion. The law of value has a far greater and more definite significance for capitalist production than that of a mere hypothesis, not to mention a fiction, even though a necessary one. Thombart, as well as Schmidt, I mention the illustrious Loria merely as an amusing, vulgar economist foil, does not make sufficient allowance for the fact that we are dealing here not only with a purely logical process, but with a historical process, and its explanatory reflection in thought, the logical pursuance of its inner connections. The decisive passage is to be found in Marx, Volume 3. Thus, the whole difficulty arises from the fact that commodities are not exchanged simply as commodities, but as products of capitals, which claim participation in the total amount of surplus value, proportional to their magnitude, or equal if they are of equal magnitude. To illustrate this difference, it is supposed that the workers are in possession of their means of production, that they work, on the average, for equally long periods of time, and with equal intensity, and exchange their commodities with one another directly. Then, in one day, two workers would have added by their labour an equal amount of new value to their products, but the product of each would have different value depending on the labour already embodied in the means of production. This latter part of the value would represent the constant capital of capitalist economy, while that part of the newly added value employed for the workers' means of subsistence would represent the variable capital, and the portion of the new value still remaining would represent the surplus value, which in this case would belong to the worker. Thus, after deducting the amount to replace the constant part of value only advanced by them, both workers would get equal values. But the ratio of the part representing surplus value to the value of the means of production, which correspond to the capitalist rate of profit, would be different in each case. But since each of them gets the value of the means of production replaced through the exchange, this would be a wholly immaterial circumstance. Marx says, quote, "The exchange of commodities at their values, or approximately at their values, thus requires a much lower stage than their exchange at their prices of production, which requires a definite level of capitalist development. Apart from the domination of prices and price movement by the law of value, it is quite appropriate to regard the values of commodities as not only theoretically, but also historically antecedent, prius, to the prices of production. This applies to conditions in which the labourer owns his own means of production, and this is the condition of the landowning working farmer and the craftsman, in the ancient as well as in the modern world. This agrees also with the view we expressed previously that the evolution of products into commodities arises through exchange between different communities, not between the members of the same community. It holds not only for this primitive condition, but also for subsequent conditions based on slavery and serfdom, and for the guild organization of handicrafts, so long as the means of production involved in each branch of production can be transferred from one sphere to another only with difficulty, and therefore the various spheres of production are related to one another within certain limits, as foreign countries or communist communities." Unquote. had Marx an opportunity to go over the third volume once more, he would doubtless have extended this passage considerably. As it stands, it gives only a sketchy outline of what is to be said on the point in question. Let us, therefore, examine it somewhat closer. We all know that at the beginning of society, products are consumed by the producers themselves, and that these producers are spontaneously organized in more or less communistic communities, that the exchange of the surplus of these products with strangers, which ushers in the conversion of products into commodities, is of a later date, that it takes place at first only between individual communities of different tribes, but later also prevails within the community and contributes considerably to the latter's dissolution into bigger or smaller family groups. But even after this dissolution, the exchanging family heads remain working peasants, who produce almost all they require with the aid of their families on their own farmsteads, and get only a slight portion of the required necessities from the outside, in exchange for surplus products of their own. The family is engaged not only in agriculture and livestock raising, it also works their products up into finished articles of consumption. Now and then it even does its own milling with the handmill. It bakes bread, spins, dyes, weaves flax and wool, tans leather, builds and repairs wooden buildings, makes tools and utensils, and not infrequently does joinery and blacksmithing, so that the family, or family group, is in the main self-sufficient. The little that such a family had to obtain by barter or buy from outside, even up to the beginning of the 19th century in Germany, consisted principally of the objects of handicraft production, that is, such things the nature of whose manufacture was by no means unknown to the peasant, and which he did not produce himself only because he lacked the raw material, or because the purchased article was much better or very much cheaper. Hence, the peasant of the Middle Ages knew fairly accurately the labour time required for the manufacture of the articles obtained by him in barter. The smith and the cartwright of the village worked under his eyes, likewise the tailor and shoemaker, who in my youth still paid their visits to our Rhine peasants, one after another turning homemade materials into shoes and clothing. The peasants, as well as the people from whom they bought, were themselves workers. The exchanged articles were each one's own products. What had they expended in making these products? Labour and labour alone. To replace tools, to produce raw material, and to process it, they spent nothing but their own labour power. How, then, could they exchange these products of theirs for those of other labouring producers, otherwise than in the ratio of labour expended on them? Not only was the labour time spent on these products the only suitable measure for the quantitative determination of the values to be exchanged, no other way was at all possible. Or is it believed that the peasant and the artisan were so stupid as to give up the product of 10 hours' labour of one person for that of a single hour's labour of another? No other exchange is possible in the whole period of peasant natural economy than that in which the exchanged quantities of commodities tend to be measured more and more according to the amounts of labour embodied in them. From the moment money penetrates into this mode of economy, the tendency towards adaptation to the law of value, in the Marxian formulation, nota bene, grows more pronounced on the one hand, while on the other it is already interrupted by the interference of usurers' capital and fleecing by taxation. The periods for which prices, on average, approach to within a negligible margin of values begin to grow longer. The same holds good for exchange between peasant products and those of the urban artisans. At the beginning, this barter takes place directly, without the medium of the merchant, on the city's market days, when the peasant sells and makes his purchases. Here, too, not only does the peasant know the artisan's working conditions, but the latter knows those of the peasant as well. For the artisan is himself still a bit of a peasant. He not only has a vegetable and fruit garden, but very often also has a small piece of land, one or two cows, pigs, poultry, etc. People in the Middle Ages were thus able to check up with considerable accuracy on each other's production costs for raw material, auxiliary material, and labour time, at least in respect of articles of daily general use. But how, in this barter on the basis of the quantity of labour, was the latter to be calculated, even if only indirectly and relatively, for products requiring a longer labour, interrupted at regular intervals, and uncertain in yield, grain or cattle, for example? And among people, to boot, who could not calculate? Obviously, only by means of a lengthy process of zigzag approximation, often feeling the way here and there in the dark, and, as is usual, learning only through mistakes. But each one's necessity for covering his own outlay, on the whole, always helped to return to the right direction, and the small number of kinds of articles in circulation, as well as the often century-long, stable nature of their production, facilitated the attaining of this goal. And that it by no means took so long for the relative amount of value of these products to be fixed fairly closely is already proved by the fact that cattle, the commodity for which this appears to be most difficult because of the long time of production of the individual head, became the first rather generally accepted money commodity. To accomplish this, the value of cattle, its exchange ratio to a large number of other commodities, must already have attained a relatively unusual stabilization, acknowledged without contradiction in the territories of many tribes. And the people of that time were certainly clever enough, both the cattle breeders and their customers, not to give away the labour time expended by them without an equivalent in barter. On the contrary, the closer people are to the primitive state of commodity production, the Russians and Orientals, for example, the more time do they still waste today in order to squeeze out, through long tenacious bargaining, the full compensation for their labour time expended on a product. Starting with this determination of value by labour time, the whole of commodity production developed, and with it the multifarious relations in which the various aspects of the law of value assert themselves, as described in the first part of Volume 1 of Capital, that is, in particular, the conditions under which labour alone is value-creating. These are conditions which assert themselves without entering the consciousness of the participants, and can themselves be abstracted from daily practice only through laborious theoretical investigation, which act, therefore, like natural laws, as Marx proved to follow necessarily from the nature of commodity production. The most important and most incisive advance was the transition to metallic money, the consequence of which, however, was that the determination of value by labour time was no longer visible upon the surface of commodity exchange. From the practical point of view, money became the decisive measure of value, all the more as the commodities entering trade became more varied, the more they came from distant countries, and the less, therefore, the labour time necessary for their production could be checked. Money itself usually came first from foreign parts. Even when precious metals were obtained within the country, the peasant and artisan were partly unable to estimate approximately the labour employed therein, and partly their own consciousness of the value-measuring property of labour had been fairly well dimmed by the habit of reckoning with money. In the popular mind, money began to represent absolute value. In a word, the Marxian law of value holds generally, as far as economic laws are valid at all, for the whole period of simple commodity production, that is, up to the time when the latter suffers a modification through the appearance of the capitalist form of production. Up to that time, prices gravitate towards the values fixed according to the Marxian law and oscillate around those values, so that the more fully simple commodity production develops, the more the average prices over long periods, uninterrupted by external violent disturbances, coincide with values within a negligible margin. Thus, the Marxian law of value has general economic validity for a period lasting from the beginning of exchange, which transforms products into commodities, down to the 15th century of the present era. But the exchange of commodities dates from a time before all written history, which in Egypt goes back to at least 2500 BC, and perhaps 5000 BC, and in Babylon to 400 BC, perhaps to 6000 BC. Thus, the law of value has prevailed during a period of from 5 to 7,000 years. And now, let us admire the thoroughness of Mr. Loria, who calls the value generally and directly valid during this period, a value at which commodities are never sold, nor can ever be sold, and with which no economist, having a spark of common sense, would ever occupy himself. We have not spoken of the merchant up to now. We could save the consideration of this intervention for now, when we pass to the transformation of simple into capitalist commodity production. The merchant was the revolutionary element in this society where everything else was stable. Stable, as it were, through inheritance, where the peasant obtained not only his hide of land, but his status as a freehold proprietor, as a free or enthralled quit-rent peasant or serf, and the urban artisan his trade and guild privileges by inheritance and almost inalienably, and each of them, in addition, his customer, his market, as well as his skill, trained from childhood for the inherited craft. Into this world then entered the merchant, with whom its revolution was to start. But not as a conscious revolutionary. On the contrary, as flesh of its flesh, bone of its bone. The merchant of the Middle Ages was by no means an individualist. He was essentially an associate, like all his contemporaries. The mark association, grown out of primitive communism, prevailed in the countryside. Each peasant originally had an equal hide, with equal pieces of land of each quality, and a corresponding equal share in the rights of the mark. After the mark had become a closed association, and no new hides were allocated any longer, subdivision of the hides occurred through inheritance, etc., with corresponding subdivisions of the common rights in the mark. But the full hide remained the unit, so that there were half, quarter, and eighth hides, with half, quarter, and eighth rights in the mark. All later productive associations, particularly the guilds in the cities, whose statutes were nothing but the application of the mark constitution to a craft privilege instead of to a restricted area of land, followed the pattern of the mark association. The central point of the whole organization was the equal participation of every member in the privileges and produce assured to the guild, as is strikingly expressed in the 1527 license of the Elberfeld and Barmen yarn trade. Tun, Industrie am Niederrhein. Industry on the Lower Rhine, Volume 2. The same holds true of the mine guilds, where each share participated equally and was also divisible, together with its rights and obligations, like the hide of the mark member. And the same holds good in no less degree of the merchant companies which initiated overseas trade. The Venetians and the Genoese in the harbour of Alexandria or Constantinople, each nation in its own fondaco, dwelling in warehouse, exhibition and sales rooms, together with central offices, formed complete trade associations. They were closed to competitors and customers. They sold at prices fixed among themselves. Their commodities had a definite quality, guaranteed by public inspection, and often by stamp. They deliberated in common on the prices to be paid by the natives for their products, etc. Nor did Hanseatic merchants act otherwise on the German bridge, Tiskabriggen, in Bergen, Norway. The same holds true of their Dutch and English competitors. Woe to the man who sold under the price, or bought above the price. The boycott that struck him meant at that time inevitable ruin, not counting the direct penalties imposed by the association upon the guilty. And even close associations were founded for definite purposes, such as the Mauna of Genoa, in the 14th and 15th centuries. For years the ruler of the alum mines in Phocaea, in Asia Minor, as well as of the island of Chios. Furthermore, the great Ravensburg Trading Company, which dealt with Italy and Spain since the end of the 14th century, founding branches in those countries. The German Company of the Augsburgers, Fugger, Welser, Wöhlin, Höchstetter, etc., that of the Nürnbergers, Hirschvogel and others, which participated with a capital of 66,000 ducats and 3 ships in the 1505-06 Portuguese exhibition to India, making a net profit of 150%, according to others 175%, Hyde, Levanter Handel, Volume 2. And a large number of other companies. Monopolia, over which Luther waxes so indignant. Here, for the first time, we meet with a profit, and a rate of profit. The merchant's efforts are deliberately and consciously aimed at making this rate of profit equal for all participants. The Venetians in the Levant, and the Hanseatics in the north, each paid the same prices for his commodities as his neighbour. His transport charges were the same. He got the same prices as every other merchant of his nation. Thus, the rate of profit was equal for all. In the big trading companies, the allocation of profit pro rata of the paid-in capital share is as much a matter of course as the participation in mark rights pro rata of the entitled hide share, or as the mining profit pro rata of the mining share. The equal rate of profit, which in its fully developed form is one of the final results of capitalist production, thus manifests itself here in its simplest form as one of the points from which capital started historically, as a direct offshoot, in fact, of the mark association, which in turn is a direct offshoot of primitive communism. This original rate of profit was necessarily very high. The business was very risky, not only because of widespread piracy. The competing nations also permitted themselves all sorts of acts of violence when the opportunity arose. Finally, sales and marketing conditions were based upon licenses granted by foreign princes, which were broken or revoked often enough. Hence the profit had to include a high insurance premium. The turnover was slow, the handling of transactions protracted, and in the best periods, which admittedly were seldom of long duration, the business was a monopoly trade with monopoly profit. The very high interest rates prevailing at the time, which always had to be lower on the whole than the percentage of usual commercial profit, also proved that the rate of profit was on the average very high. But this high rate of profit, equal for all participants and obtained through joint labour of the community, held only locally within the associations, that is, in this case, the nation. Venetians, Genoese, Hanseatics, and Dutchmen each had a special rate of profit, and at the beginning, more or less each individual market area as well. Equalization of these different company profit rates took place in the opposite way, through competition. First, the profit rates of the different markets for one and the same nation. If Alexandria offered more profit for Venetian goods than Cyprus, Constantinople, or Trebizond, the Venetians would start more capital moving towards Alexandria, withdrawing it from trade with other markets. Then the gradual equalization of profit rates among the different nations exporting the same or similar goods to the same markets had to follow, and some of these nations were very often squeezed to the wall and disappeared from the scene. But this process was being continually interrupted by political events, just as all Levantine trade collapsed owing to the Mongolian and Turkish invasions. The great geographic commercial discoveries after 1492 only accelerated this decline, and then made it final. The sudden expansion of the market area that followed the revolution in communications connected with it introduced no essential change at first in the nature of trade operations. At the beginning, cooperative companies also dominated trade with India and America. But in the first place, bigger nations stood behind these companies. In trade with America, the whole of Great United Spain took the place of the Catalonians trading with the Levant. Alongside it, two countries like England and France, and even Holland and Portugal, the smallest, were still at least as large and strong as Venice, the greatest and strongest trading nation of the preceding period. This gave the travelling merchant, the merchant adventurer of the 16th and 17th centuries, a backing that made the company, which protected its companions with arms, also more and more superfluous, and its expenses an outright burden. Moreover, the wealth in a single hand grew considerably faster, so that single merchants soon could invest as large sums in an enterprise as formerly an entire company. The trading companies, wherever still existent, were usually converted into armed corporations, which conquered and monopolistically exploited whole newly discovered countries under the protection and the sovereignty of the mother country. But the more colonies were founded in the new areas, largely by the state, the more did company trade recede before that of the individual merchant, and the equalization of the profit rate became therewith more and more a matter of competition exclusively. Up to now, we have become acquainted with a rate of profit only for merchant capital. For only merchant and usurer's capital had existed up to that time. Industrial capital was yet to be developed. Production was still predominantly in the hands of workers owning their own means of production, whose work therefore yielded no surplus value to any capital. If they had to surrender a part of the product to third parties without compensation, it was in the form of tribute to feudal lords. Merchant capital, therefore, could only make its profit, at least at the beginning, out of the foreign buyers of domestic products, or the domestic buyers of foreign products. Only toward the end of this period, for Italy, that is, with the decline of Levantine trade, were foreign competition and the difficulty of marketing able to compel the handicraft producers of export commodities to sell the commodity under its value to the exporting merchant. And thus we find here that commodities are sold at their value, on the average, in the domestic retail trade of individual producers with one another, but for the reasons given, not in international trade as a rule. Quite the opposite of the present-day world, where the production prices hold good in international and wholesale trade, while the formations of prices in urban retail trade is governed by quite other rates of profit. So that the meat of an ox, for example, experiences today a greater rise in price on its way from the London wholesaler to the individual London consumer than from the wholesaler in Chicago, including transport, to the London wholesaler. The instrument that gradually brought about this revolution in price formation was industrial capital. Rudiments of the latter had been formed as early as the Middle Ages, in three fields, shipping, mining, and textiles. Shipping on the scale practiced by the Italian and Hanseatic maritime republics was impossible without sailors, that is, wage labourers, whose wage relationship may have been concealed under association forms with profit-sharing, or without oarsmen, wage labourers or slaves, for the galleys of that day. The guilds in the ore mines, originally associated workers, had already been converted in almost every case into stock companies for exploiting the deposits by means of wage labourers. And in the textile industry, the merchant had begun to place the little master weaver directly in his service by supplying him with yarn and having it made into cloth for his account in return for a fixed wage, in short, by himself changing from a mere buyer into a so-called contractor. Here we have the first beginnings of the formation of capitalist surplus value. We can ignore the mining guilds as closed monopoly corporations. With regard to the ship owners, it is obvious that their profit had to be at least as high as the customary one in the country, plus an extra increment for insurance, depreciation of ships, etc. But how were matters with the textile contractors, who first brought commodities directly manufactured for capitalist account into competition with the commodities of the same sort made for handicraft account? Merchant capital's rate of profit was at hand to start with. Likewise, it had already been equalized to an approximate average rate, at least for the locality in question. Now, what could induce the merchant to take on the extra business of a contractor? Only one thing. The prospect of greater profit at the same selling price as the others. And he had this prospect. By taking the little master into his service, he broke through the traditional bonds of production within which the producer sold his finished product, and nothing else. The merchant capitalist bought the labour power, which still owned its production instruments, but no longer the raw material. By thus guaranteeing the weaver regular employment, he could depress the weaver's wage to such a degree that a part of the labour time furnished remained unpaid for. The contractor thus became an appropriator of surplus value over and above his commercial profit. Admittedly, he had to employ additional capital to buy yarn, etc., and leave it in the weaver's hands until the article for which he formerly had to pay full price only upon purchasing it was finished. But in the first place, he had already used extra capital in most cases for advances to the weaver, who as a rule submitted to the new production conditions only under the pressure of debt. And secondly, apart from that, the calculation took the following form. Assume that our merchant operates his export business with capital of 30,000 ducats, sequins, pounds sterling, or whatever is the case. Of that, say 10,000 are engaged in the purchase of domestic goods, whereas 20,000 are used in the overseas market. Say the capital is turned over once in 2 years. Annual turnover equals 15,000. Now, our merchant wants to become a contractor to have cloth woven for his own account. How much additional capital must he invest? Let us assume that the production time of the piece of cloth, such as he sells, averages 2 months, which is certainly very high. Let us further assume that he has to pay for everything in cash. Hence, he must advance enough capital to supply his weavers with yarn for 2 months. Since his turnover is 15,000 a year, he buys cloth for 2,500 in 2 months. Let us say that 2,000 of that represents the value of yarn, and 500 weavers' wages. Then our merchant requires an additional capital of 2,000. We assume that the surplus value he appropriates from the weaver by the new method totals only 5% of the value of the cloth, which constitutes the certainly very modest surplus value rate of 25%. 2000C plus 500V plus 125S. S prime, rate of surplus value, equals 125 over 500 equals 25%. P prime, rate of profit, equals 125 over 2,500 equals 5%. Our man then makes an extra profit of 750 on his annual turnover of 15,000, and has thus got his additional capital back in 2 2/3 years. But in order to accelerate his sales, and hence his turnover, thus making the same profit with the same capital in a shorter period of time, and hence a greater profit in the same time, he will donate a small portion of his surplus value to the buyer. He will sell cheaper than his competitors. These will also gradually be converted into contractors, and then the extra profit for all of them will be reduced to the ordinary profit, or even to a lower profit on the capital that has been increased for all of them. The equality of the profit rate is re-established, although possibly on another level, by a part of the surplus value made at home being turned over to the foreign buyers. The next step in the subjugation of industry by capital takes place through the introduction of manufacture. This, too, enables the manufacturer, who is most often his own export trader in the 17th and 18th centuries, generally in Germany down to 1850 and still today here and there, to produce cheaper than his old-fashioned competitor, the handicraftsman. The same process is repeated. The surplus value appropriated by the manufacturing capitalist enables him, or the export merchant who shares with him, to sell cheaper than his competitors until the general introduction of the new mode of production, when equalization again takes place. The already existing mercantile rate of profit, even if it is levelled out only locally, remains the Procrustean bed, in which the excessive industrial surplus value is lopped off, without mercy. If manufacturing sprung ahead by cheapening its products, this is even more true of modern industry, which forces the production costs of commodities lower and lower through its repeated revolutions in production, relentlessly eliminating all former modes of production. It is large-scale industry, too, that thus finally conquers the domestic market for capital, puts an end to the small-scale production and natural economy of the self-sufficient peasant family, and places the entire nation in service of capital. Likewise, it equalizes the profit rate of the different commercial and industrial branches of business into one general rate of profit, and finally ensures industry the position of power due to it in this equalization by eliminating most of the obstacles formerly hindering the transfer of capital from one branch to another. Thereby, the conversion of values into production prices is accomplished for all exchange as a whole. This conversion therefore proceeds according to objective laws, without the consciousness or the intent of the participants. Theoretically, there is no difficulty at all in the fact that competition reduces to the general level profits which exceed the general rate, thus again depriving the first industrial appropriator of the surplus value exceeding the average. All the more so in practice, however, for the spheres of production with excessive surplus value, with high variable and low constant capital, that is, with low capital composition, are by their very nature the ones that are last and least completely subjected to capitalist production, especially agriculture. On the other hand, the rise of production prices above commodity values, which is required to raise the below-average surplus value contained in the products of the spheres of high capital composition, to the level of the average rate of profit, appears to be extremely difficult theoretically, but is soonest and most easily effected in practice, as we have seen. For when commodities of this class are first produced capitalistically and enter capitalist commerce, they compete with commodities of the same nature produced by per capitalist methods, and hence dearer. Thus, even if the capitalist producer renounces a part of the surplus value, he can still obtain the rate of profit prevailing in his locality, which originally had no direct connection with surplus value, because it had arisen from merchant capital long before there was any capitalist production at all, and therefore before an industrial rate of profit was possible. The Stock Exchange. 1. The position of the stock exchange in capitalist production in general is clear from Volume 3, Part 5, especially Chapter 27. But since 1865, when this volume was written, a change has taken place which today assigns a considerably increased and constantly growing role to the stock exchange, and which, as it develops, tends to concentrate all production, industrial as well as agricultural, and all commerce, the means of communication as well as the functions of exchange, in the hands of stock exchange operators, so that the stock exchange becomes the most prominent representative of capitalist production itself. 2. In 1865, the stock exchange was still a secondary element in the capitalist system. Government bonds represented the bulk of exchange securities, and even their sum total was still relatively small. Besides, there were joint stock banks, predominant on the continent and in America, and just beginning to absorb the aristocratic private banks in England, but still relatively insignificant en masse. Railway shares were still comparatively weak compared to the present time. There were still only few directly productive establishments in stock company form, and, like the banks, most of all in the poorer countries, Germany, Austria, America, etc. The minister's eye was still an unconquered superstition. At that time, the stock exchange was still a place where the capitalists took away each other's accumulated capital, and which directly concerned the workers only as new proof of the demoralizing general effect of capitalist economy, and as confirmation of the Calvinist doctrine that predestination, alias chance, decides, even in this life, blessedness and damnation, wealth, that is, enjoyment and power, and poverty, that is, privation and servitude. 3. Now it is otherwise. Since the crisis of 1866, accumulation has proceeded with ever-increasing rapidity, so that in no industrial country, least of all in England, could the expansion of production keep up with that of accumulation, or the accumulation of the individual capitalist be completely utilized in the enlargement of his own business. English cotton industry as early as 1845. The railway swindles. But with this accumulation, the number of rentiers, people who were fed up with the regular tension in business and therefore wanted merely to amuse themselves or to follow a mild pursuit as directors or governors of companies, also rose. And third, in order to facilitate the investment of this mass floating around as money capital, new legal forms of limited liability companies were established, wherever that had not yet been done. And the liability of the shareholder, formerly unlimited, was also reduced, more or less. Joint stock companies in Germany, 1890, 40% of subscription. 4. Thereafter, gradual conversion of industry into stock companies. One branch after another suffers this fate. First iron, where giant plants are now necessary. Before that, mines, where not already organized on shares. Then the chemical industry. Likewise, machinery plants. On the continent, the textile industry. In England, only in a few areas in Lancashire, Oldham Spinning Mill, Burnley Weaving Mill, etc. Tailor cooperatives. But this is only a preliminary stage, which will again fall into the master's hands at the next crisis. Breweries. The American ones sold a few years ago to English capital. Then Guinness, Bass, Allsop. Then the trusts, which create gigantic enterprises under common management, such as United Alkali. The ordinary individual firm is more and more only a preliminary stage to bring the business to the point where it is big enough to be founded. Likewise in trade, Leafs, Parsons, Morley's, Morrison, Dillon, all founded. The same in retail stores by now, and not merely under the cloak of cooperation a la cooperative wholesale society. Likewise banks and other credit establishments, even in England. A tremendous number of new banks, all shares delimited. Even old banks, etc., are converted, with 7 private shareholders, into limited companies. 5. The same in the field of agriculture. The enormously expanded banks, especially in Germany, under all sorts of bureaucratic names, more and more the holders of mortgages. With their shares, the actual higher ownership of landed property is transferred to the stock exchange. And this is even more true when the farms fall into the creditors' hands. Here, the agricultural revolution of prairie cultivation is very impressive. If it continues, the time can be foreseen when England's and France's land will also be in the hands of the stock exchange. 6. Now all foreign investments in the form of shares. To mention England alone, American railways, North and South, consult the stock exchange list, Goldberger, etc. 7. Then, colonization. Today, this is purely a subsidiary of the Stock Exchange, in whose interests the European powers divided Africa a few years ago, and the French conquered Tunis and Tonkin. Africa leased directly to companies, Niger, South Africa, German Southwest and German East Africa, and Mashonaland and Natal, seized by Rhodes for the Stock Exchange.